Welcome to this State of Opportunity special, when neighbors say more than hello. I'm Cynthia Canty. What's the most important thing to consider when you're choosing a neighborhood? Your real estate agent would probably tell you location, location, location. But what makes one neighborhood different from another just a few blocks over? One key factor, the relationships among the people living there. In other words, neighbors, neighbors, neighbors. Just how well do you know your neighbors? Today, you'll meet neighbors from three different Michigan communities, people working together to solve local problems. They're not waiting around for someone else to fix it. They're digging in, and they're doing it for themselves. Not only do these grassroots efforts yield creative solutions, it turns out that really getting to know the people who live around you can have a profound impact on your life. And there's research to back this up. Jeffrey Morinoff is director of the Population Studies Center at the University of Michigan. Jeffrey, what do we really know about how neighborhoods shape our lives?
Well, I would say there's at least four critical dimensions on which neighborhoods shape our lives. One of them you've already alluded to, which is who you live near and how you interact with those people. So that's something that sociologists in particular are very interested in because it pertains to the kinds of interactions you have with your neighbors. But there are also other dimensions. Another dimension, for example, is the kinds of stress that you might be exposed to from different kinds of events or the presence of different kinds of industries or actors. And that ties into a third, which is the physical environment itself. And that could come from pollution in the air, as we've seen more recently, water pollution, and even exposure to noise can have a big impact. And then the final one would be the kinds of institutions and organizations that are in your neighborhood. Another intuitive point, but they make a big difference.
So all of that can really have an impact on physical and mental health.
Absolutely. So there's been studies looking both at the mental and the physical side, and on the physical side, trying to drill down and look at specifically what kinds of health outcomes and also look for evidence that it really is having a physical effect on your health, not just an effect on the people who are reporting the status of their health.
And Jeffrey, here we live in a country where, you know, your zip code is shaped very largely in part by your income, and low-income people, especially those who are minorities, are much more likely to live in a neighborhood with concentrated poverty. So how hard is it to disentangle the effects of poverty and the influence of neighborhoods?
There's a classic article called Poor People and Poor Places, and it's very important to conceptually distinguish between what we mean here. The individual experience of living in poverty can be very profound, but there is also evidence to suggest that if you take people of varying socioeconomic levels and compare the ones that are living in more impoverished neighborhoods to the ones who are living in better-off neighborhoods, that the environment around them still makes a big difference. And that goes back to those four main reasons that I described before.
So let's look at then this relationship, because if, you know, as you say, you may not be able to control the fact that there is, as we've seen in Flint, water that is tainted, or folks in the southwest Wayne County, Detroit area when the Petcoke was blowing through. So you've got these environmental factors. So the thing you can control, in a sense, is relationship amongst each other. Does that actually provide an insulation, in a sense, from some of these external effects that you may not be able to control as well?
Yes. I should say that there's not conclusive and definitive evidence on this, and this research is still in its infancy. However, there is evidence to suggest that those kinds of social support structures can buffer people, especially when they are experiencing very stressful times or very stressful environments. One area where you see the most research on this probably is exposure to violent crime in areas around where people live. And having a support structure is one of the factors that does help to mitigate those kind of harmful effects on – especially on the lives of children and their development, their cognitive skills, their academic achievement.
And when you say support structure, what might that look like, you know, from house to house, along street to street?
Well, it begins inside the family. And I think for different ages, different elements are more important. When you're an infant or a toddler, it's your parents that are the most important. When you move up to elementary school age, the school system itself becomes more of a factor. And then when you reach adolescence, it's the peers, your similar age kids around you, and wider influences of the neighborhood. And then when you go into adulthood, institutions become much more important in your day-to-day life, the kinds of services they provide, the businesses around you, but also the provision of health care and law enforcement is also a huge issue.
Is this what we talk about when we say social cohesion? What do we mean by that?
Yeah, social cohesion means different things to different people. But in the way that I've studied it and many other social scientists have studied it, it's the degree to which people trust and interact with one another and share, or at least think they share, common values with the people who live around them.
And I am guessing that does not have necessarily have anything to do with income level or socioeconomic status, that you could have social cohesion in a neighborhood that is a low-income or stressed neighborhood and never see it in a high-income neighborhood.
Absolutely. And this is why this mechanism is so fascinating to sociologists, for exactly the reason you said, because it does not get strongly patterned by the amount of income you make or the amount of wealth that you have. It depends on other factors. Some of them are geographic factors about the neighborhood itself. Mm-hmm. Some of them are more social, like how long have people lived in that neighborhood and whether there is a preponderance of kids in the neighborhood, which are one of the ways that people get to meet each other.
So when we think about where we are largely as a country, so many of us, where we barely know the neighbors around us, you might know who's next door, one side or the other, and that's it. How did we get to that point where we're knowing a lot of neighbors around us is the exception rather than the rule?
That's a very complicated question, and I think goes back to a long history of urban growth and decline, and now maybe revitalization, moving out to the suburbs to more expansive tracts of land, becoming more geographically isolated from our neighbors. But I think that now, and not just now, but maybe for the last decade or so, people are starting to reappreciate the value of knowing your neighbors. And developers are constructing housing communities that reflect that and that have people living in higher density communities and where they can stimulate more interactions between neighbors.
When I think of the kind of houses we saw built in the suburbs through the 90s and the 2000s, no front porch. And everything is on the back, the deck, the patio. It does not – you just – nobody's sitting out front the way that I remember us doing growing up in the city of Ferndale in the 50s and 60s.
Another historical reflection of that is changes in the way that police do their job. Mm-hmm. Way back at the beginning of American policing, the cops would walk the beat. But then – beginning in around the 1940s, where reform efforts came underway in part to combat corruption – there was an emphasis on police not living in the same neighborhood and riding around in patrol cars and not getting out and talking to neighbors. They thought that the more distance they had, the more objective they could be and the more fair they could be. But then that has reversed itself in more recent years, and there's been a return to an emphasis on community policing so that, mm-hmm. that police are, again, walking the beat, trying to find out what's happening in the neighborhood and trying to build on the cohesion that exists among neighbors and, if possible, create more of it.
Jeffrey, can you give us a sense, maybe an example from the research that would show us how social cohesion can change a neighborhood?
I can give you an example that you might find a little bit counterintuitive. But in my research on returning prisoners, I asked them this question. What is it about the place that you live that really is making a difference, do you think, in your ability to reintegrate into society? And one of the unexpected answers that I got was the degree to which a community supports recovery really matters. So the degree to which maybe they have recovering drug addicts and alcoholics who attend regular meetings and who see each other on a day-to-day basis and can know whether you're falling off the wagon or whether you're still with the program, so to speak, really makes a concrete difference in their lives.
People around you who have shared your kinds of experiences.
Exactly. People who have shared your kinds of experiences.
There are so many things we cannot control about their neighbors, about our neighborhoods. But do you think some of the research on neighborhoods could help give everyone a blueprint or a template to the kinds of things that neighbors can do that would really make a difference in improving everyone's lives?
I don't think that the science is quite at that point yet where we can offer specific prescriptive remedies for what you can do to inject your neighborhood with more social cohesion or a magic pill that's going to improve everybody's quality of life. But I think that many of the things that we've been talking about, having a more stable residential base, knowing who your neighbors are, the more little steps that you can take to create informal organization among neighbors, mm-hmm. or to participate in more formal voluntary associations and other organizations that exist in the neighborhood, that would probably, I would guess, make everybody better off in the long run.
Well, we'll get some good examples of that later in this hour. Jeffrey Morinoff directs the Population Studies Center at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.